Very good. Let's get right into it. The first question is, hello, you told us to feel life, but then we have to stand back and not get involved. Why do we encourage contact in the first place? By the way, why do you only shave your eyebrows, not your ear here? It is prominent too. The reason is the long hair in the ear is a sign of wisdom. If ever you've seen Star Wars, apparently Yoda has hair coming out of his ears. So this is a sign of wisdom. This has got no sign at all. So, and it's also some of the questions which I receive, I would raise my eyebrows at them if I had some. So that's in order for me to look equanimous no matter what happens. So you can't raise an eyebrow when you ain't got any. But anyway, to feel life when you have to stand back and not get involved, this is with your thoughts to stand back and not get involved. But first of all, it's a skillful means to get you from sort of thinking too much into real life. That's why it's very good to be able to feel the sensations of the body to begin with, as a skillful means at the very beginning. So you don't think about the cold or the heat, you feel it. You know, you can feel the wind, you can listen to the birds, you can even listen to the traffic, you can see the stars at night. That gets you into the present moment, it stops you thinking. So it's part of Kayagata Sati, the first Satipatthana, to actually feel the body, know where you are instead of thinking about it. So that's why you feel that as a beginning to stop you thinking. And then, later on, you close your eyes and let those five senses disappear and vanish. But to begin with, to the start, at least, be in real life before you let it go. Dear Ajahn, are the higher enlightenment experience uniquely different in feel, or they are a revisiting of the experience of stream winning? Oh, you mean seeing once returning, non-returning, and arahat. The best simile of that, because it's from the suttas, the word of the Buddha, but it's also a metaphor where you can understand from the metaphor exactly what these stages of enlightenment are. And it's the simile of the shipwrecked sailors. And the last four, there's a whole seven, I won't go into the first three of them. The first of the last four is a sailor whose boat has gone down, they're floating in the ocean, don't know which way to go, and they're looking around and they can see in the distance dry land. They can see land in the distance. That's the stream winner. And then once you can see land, you start swimming towards it. And that's the once returner. And they never actually say how far you swam, whether it's a third of the way or half the way or two thirds of the way. But at least you're on your way. And then you're so close to the land, you don't need to swim anymore. You can actually stand and feel, you know, the sand under your feet. You're in the surf, close to the beach. You can wade the rest of the way to the shore. That's the non-returner. So close. And then afterwards you've waded to the shore. You really are sitting on dry land now. That's the arahat. It's a very beautiful simile because it tells you that the first stage of enlightenment is to actually see what the safety is. And then, of course, you start practicing to get closer to the safety. But you always, you know, see the land. It gets clearer and clearer as you're coming closer and closer. And then when you're a non-returner, you're really so close, there's very, very little difference between a non-returner and a full enlightened arahat. So, that's a very beautiful simile which answers many questions of the made by the Buddha so you can visualize what this path of enlightenment is. Da-da-da. Dear Ajahn, why was that you lost your deep meditation when your first day and it took a while to get it back? Yeah, that's an experience which many monks have. As a layperson, I had some really good meditation, but then I became a monk and it took a while. The main reason is because I wanted it back. And I wanted, and stupid at the time, never really understood what meditation is and how to meditate. Had a lot of theories, a lot of thoughts, but after a while you soon figured out I wanted it back, and that is why it never came. And soon as instead of wanting the result, the deep meditation, I realized that what I should be working on is the causes. Put the causes in place, and the result, the effect comes. So I realized that all these are the stages of letting go. So I really needed to let go as much as I can, be content, be peaceful, not have any wanting. Comes, it comes. If it doesn't come, it doesn't come. So I worked on the causes rather than the results. I know this is not the best simile, but it's the best I could come up with. It's just like you see all the dishes which need to be washed after lunch. And you start thinking, oh, when's the dish? I want the dishes to be washed. When are they going to be washed? When are they going to be washed? That's just looking at the result. And it never happens. So then you think, how do the dishes, you know, end up being clean? By washing them. So you start washing them. You don't think about when they're going to be finished. You just wash them and wash them and wash another one. And soon the dishes are finished. Just like getting deep meditations. I want jhana, I want jhana, I want jhana. I want it now. That's just like wanting the dishes to wash themselves. So instead, you've got to look at the causes. Why do these deep states of meditation happen? Because you let go. You make peace. You're kind. You're gentle. You're patient. And if you lose that patience, it doesn't happen. If you want, it doesn't happen. If you let go, as a means of getting what you want, that doesn't happen either. So instead, you just, oh, it comes, doesn't come, it doesn't come. That is the way. And of course, it's a good opportunity to introduce the Ananda method of enlightenment, getting to deep meditation. If you don't know this story, Ananda, not the gentleman sitting in front of me here, but the chief disciple of the Buddha, the attendant of the Buddha, listened to all these amazing teachings. And he's sitting next to the Buddha for 25 years, listening to these great teachings, and this monk comes along and says he's enlightened, and another nun comes up and says she's enlightened, and he wasn't enlightened at all. And so, when the Buddha said he was going to die soon, and when the Buddha did get very close to dying, poor old Ananda was so disappointed and depressed. If I can't get enlightened, literally sitting next to the greatest teacher ever, the Buddha himself, what hope would there be for me once a Buddha has passed away? And the Buddha did pass away. And Ananda was not enlightened. And he felt very, very depressed. But what happened about 3 or 4 months after the Buddha passed away? They had a big meeting of all the great monks and so to try and collect all of the teachings of the Buddha, so that we can actually find out what the Buddha said, what the Buddha didn't say. So there'd be no confusion. Fresh after the Buddha passed away, while it was still in people's memories. So they organized a big conference. They say 500 arahats they wanted, fully enlightened ones. But then they mentioned, what about Ananda? He'd heard so much, had a great memory. We should invite him as well. So it became 499 arahats. And Ananda, the dummy. Now, when you go to a meeting and you're the odd one out, all your friends, you know, have got degrees, but you've never even been to university, you really feel just, you know, embarrassed. So Ananda felt so embarrassed The next day he'd have to go to a meeting and he was the only one out of 500 who wasn't enlightened. Just like if I told you the last day of this retreat that every one of you had got jhanas and were enlightened except for you. How would you feel? I've been coming here a long time. I've been giving donations to the monastery. These people, they just rock up, never done anything, and they get enlightened, and they just straight away. It's really unfair. That's how Ananda felt. So that night, he decided to give it everything he got. The enlightenment or bust. Never ever do that. It's always, every time, bust. But Ananda just gave it everything he got. All night he meditated. Never went to sleep. Using every trick he knew from the word of the Buddha himself. Nothing worked. When the dawn came up, he was nowhere close to enlightenment, he thought. So what he did? There was another couple of hours before the meeting. So take a nap. So that's what he did. He went to his room, just hopeless, gave up, and he took a nap. And just before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th enlightened one. When he stopped trying, when he let go, when he didn't want anything, that is when it happened. And according to the story, I always like saying this at the very end, according to the story, that he, once he was enlightened, he got psychic powers as well, very gifted, and he decided to deliberately be late. So they waited for him, and the 499 arahats thought he's not coming, so they locked the door to start their meeting. And after they locked the door, Ananda, using his new psychic powers, he came into the meeting through the keyhole. It is called, as I often say, making an entrance. So they all realize that this fellow has got enlightened. He's one of us now. And I always call that the Ananda method of enlightenment. So after this talk is finished, give it a try. Go to bed. Obviously, the more times you do that, the more chance there is of working. But the point was, he let go. He was stopped trying. And that was my problem, many people's problems. You have a really beautiful experience in meditation, very deep, very profound. You want it back. And you want the result back. You forget about the causes. So always focus on the causes. Why you got a deep meditation. Put those causes back in place. And you've got a good chance. Ajahn Brahm. How can I observe my mindfulness becoming more and more powerful? It makes me feel closely connected to myself. But I'm afraid, how will I sustain it when I go back to my busy lay life? You're not back in your busy lay life yet. Stop going into the future. It's another, I don't know, how many more days till it finishes? I don't know, I forgot. A long time before this retreat finishes. So don't even think of going back until the last day when you have to go back. So first of all, that's not a question until the very last day. What do you do when you go back to your lay life? You may not make it that far. Who knows? People do die, you know. So how can you observe your mindfulness becoming more and more powerful instead of feeling it connected to yourself? The more it's connected to yourself, the weaker it gets. Where there's a self, there is control. When you say it's my mindfulness, then you have to take responsibility for it. And when it's weak, you feel guilty. When it's strong, yes, look at me. I'm so mindful today. Well, that means it just really messes it up. It's not your mindfulness. It's just mindfulness. Comes according to its causes and gets weakened according to causes. So your job is just to be still and watch mindfulness get strong. But there's another thing about stillness. When you develop stillness, things disappear. The more still you are, the more your sense of self diminishes and vanishes. To have a strong sense of self, you have to have a strong will in doing stuff. It is the will which creates the sense of self. I am Donald Trump. Look what I've done. Billionaire. President of the United States. I've worked for that. My will created this. That's why such people have big egos. The ones who really struggled and worked hard and used their will. You know, you've been close to people like that. They're pains in the ass to be with. All because you've done things. The doing creates the sense of self. Letting go, it's not just letting go of will. You're letting go of the thing which does the willing, you. So little by little, the more you let go, the more you vanish. You disappear. You're not there anymore. That's why letting go, being still, watching your mindfulness increase, also watches your sense of self, your identity, getting less and less and less and less. It vanishes. The art of disappearing. You are gone. I mention that in passing at the first night's talk when people say, can Ajahn Brahm get jhana? I have to vanish. Where there's a will, there's Ajahn Brahm. When there's no will, Ajahn Brahm vanishes. You go, you disappear. I have to disappear. And then the jhanas happen. You have to vanish too. That's why when you want it, when you're doing it, it never happens. It is a taste of freedom. A freedom from this self which wants to do, own and attain. Dear Ajahn, I have heard by doing walking meditation some monks have attained arahat state. With metta meditation, will it give the same results? Vehicle doesn't matter, it is the progress of the mind, is it? Yeah, it is. Walking meditation, sitting meditation, metta meditation. I tell this, what's the difference between them? I tell these stories every retreat. I don't know why people keep on coming retreat after retreat after retreat. I always tell the same stories. But you know that. You come here, so don't blame me. You know what's going to happen. So, sometimes a person comes along and I teach them breath meditation. And then they come along and saying it's too difficult for me, so then I teach them Anapanasati. And when they can't do Anapanasati, then I give them metta meditation. And when they can't do metta meditation, they find it difficult, I teach them loving kindness. And if they can't do loving kindness, I teach them to let go. Just open the door of your heart and just let it happen. And if they can't do letting go meditation, I might teach walking meditation. If they can't do walking meditation, I teach them Chankama meditation. That's actually the party for walking meditation. And if they can't do walking meditation, then body scan meditation. If they can't do body scan meditation, then I teach them Anapanasati, by which time they forget that's where they started. They just go round and round and round, because it's all the same. It's not what you watch, but how you watch it. Doesn't matter at all, you're watching a stupid, restless mind, or you're watching a mind which is half asleep, you're watching the breath, you're watching nimittas. What's important is how you're watching it. Are you really letting go, or are you controlling? Are you making peace, or are you trying to get somewhere? Are you kind, or do you want to get rid of stuff? Are you patient, or are you want to, come on, quick, 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 I've only got a few more days left. So it's how you meditate is more important than what you're meditating on. Dear Ajahn, I have a friend who's lost 70 kilos from 135 kilos, that's not talking about me obviously, and now very scared of eating and hardly eat. Can you kindly advise how I can help her in a Buddhist way? Yeah, it's I wish I could get this photograph for you, because I saw this photograph. It was a t-shirt which somebody was wearing. And he was wearing a t-shirt. The guy was really fat. And on the t-shirt it said, "I beat anorexia." But actually, do you know what anorexia is? Because I looked in a dictionary once to find its definition. And anorexia was saying just you look in the mirror and you think you're fat. And then I realised what I've got. Every time I look in the mirror, I think I'm fat, so that's I'm anorexic. Well, it fits. But anyway, my next excuse. Look, this is not fat. I have been a monk. I thought it said 42 years. This is my 43rd year now being a monk. Coming up to the 43rd year since I ordained as first a novice and a full monk. And every year you're a monk, you get kinder and kinder. You practice metta, loving kindness. You actually grow compassion. So imagine 42 years, 43 years, and that's been my practice, learning how to be more and more kind and more compassionate. So every year, as a monk, my heart gets bigger and bigger. A long time ago, my heart got so big it couldn't push any more against the ribcage. So my heart, as it grew bigger and bigger, went down and out. It's the only place it could go. So this is not fat. This is just a big heart. Compassionate. You're going to get a big heart to go somewhere. And when you understand that, and it's absolutely true, all the fat monks I know were so kind. You know, Ajahn Gunha, you've been to see him, he's a fat monk. Ajahn Chah was fat. All the thin monks, people like Ajahn Mahabua, he was just so tough and unkind. Check it out. I always say, never trust a thin monk. They give you a very hard time. Same goes for thin nuns. And anyway, you know, we always have role models we try and live up to. And my role model had two role models, spiritual role models when I was young. You know, not people like the Pope, you know, because, you know, that was just too, or Archbishop of Canterbury, they were too serious. I wanted to serve people who've been practicing spirituality for a long time, were kind, the sort of person I'd like to be. And the first person, he was a character, a very well-known character on a TV show, but, you know, it's based on a very, very ancient sort of story of, you know, Robin Hood. Friar Tuck. Do you remember Friar Tuck in Robin Hood series? Really kind, very wise, but very tubby too. But he was my first role model, and my second role model was even more impressive. Really fat and most generous person in the world, just renowned for his kindness and generosity, especially to children. And always happy, always fat, and he was so long-lived, one of the oldest people I know. Father Christmas. Santa Claus. Now he is a religious role model for all of us. Always generous, always happy, ho, 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 and always fat. So, and he was old when I was young. He's still alive today. See him still in supermarkets on the TV. So there you go. So, that's my other role model. So anyway, just scared of eating and hardly eating. Look, that's going to really make you sick. Really sick. So the answer was that story which, again, from a science magazine, that if you're happy, not fake happiness, real happiness, you laugh easily, then your blood vessels dilate. When you're happy, you know your arteries and veins actually get bigger. When you're miserable, angry, tense, they get narrower. You know, which explains something. The only fat people you see alive are the happy ones. Because the miserable ones, they've got so much cholesterol and other gut going through their system. If their blood vessels get small, of course, they clog. As for me, my blood vessels, I've been laughing and happy monk for such a long time. I tell stupid jokes and I don't care whether you laugh because I laugh. You laughing is just a bonus for me. And Venerable Bada will tell you, it wasn't that long ago, a couple of years ago, Ajahn Brahmani got very, very scared because I was laughing so much at one of my own jokes that sort of I almost asphyxiated. I couldn't breathe. I'm sure that's the way I'm going to die. Just laughing and not being able to catch my breath. So anyway, that my laugh so much, my blood vessels are so wide, you never have a traffic jam in them. They've got so many extra lanes in there. So of course they don't clog. So that is why happy people, the fat people, the only ones you see are happy ones. Because the fat, miserable people, they died a long time ago. Same as you. Even if you're thin, please be happy. Because every time you laugh, every time you smile, actually your blood vessels dilate. That's just basic science. Stops heart attacks. That's why my retreats, people are actually really healthy. No one gets heart attacks. How does one stop identity making, i.e. job status, layperson, etc.? How does one overcome the fear and limitation of holding to identity and ownership? I already answered that question. Look at the link between your will, your striving, and your identity. So if it succeeds, you get proud. I did this. I made this. Look at me. Your ego gets stronger. And if it fails, why do you suffer? Because you think, I am a failure. When you let go of will, oh, it's not my problem. It works. Great. It doesn't work. Even better. Then I don't have to do it again. When you're at school, if you pass your exam, don't think, yeah, how smart I am. Always remember, if you fail your exam, then you don't have to do more next year. They kick you out. That's the only way to, because if you pass exams, you always have to take some more next year, harder ones. You do all the exams in year 12s, and then you go to do them in universities, you finally get your degree, and then you do more exams for masters, and then more for a PhD, and then for other stuff. It only ends when you fail. Once you fail, you're free. I'm giving your kid bad advice. Or is it good advice? So anyway, that's how we stop identity making. The job, it's not you. I am only a part-time abbot. When I meditate, I'm not an abbot anymore. Can you please tell us the story of the monk and the weatherman? Oh, that was in good, bad, who knows. Okay, I love telling stories. You know, even I've heard them before, but I still love telling them. The monk and the weatherman. There was a monastery in the north of India. And the old abbot, very wise with great powers, had just passed away. So the monks, they elected a replacement abbot. He was young, no, quite wise, but just still learning the jobs. He wasn't as attained and powerful as the old abbot. So when he got to in October, the monks in the mountains asked the abbot, said, is it going to be a cold winter this year? Should we collect lots of wood to heat up the monastery? And the old monk would always use his powers to predict whether it's going to be a cold winter or a mild winter. And he was always right. He was just such an amazing monk. But the new monk, he hadn't got that power yet. And he didn't want to admit that he hadn't. So he said, let me meditate on this tonight, and I'll tell you in the morning. And so that night, in the middle of the night, he got out his smartphone and called the weatherman. And he got through, not just the ordinary one, to the professor at the university, the Department of Meteorology. And he tried to be anonymous, He said, I'm just a general member of the public, but I need to know whether it's going to be a cold winter this year up in the mountains. And the weatherman said, yeah, I think probably. And so, thank you so much. And the following morning, the monk and the head monk announced to all his other monks, said, I can see that this year will be a cold winter. We have to get lots of wood. So all the monks accepted that. So they worked really hard, you know, collecting some wood from here and wood from there, you know, stuffing all their storerooms with lots of wood. And then at the end of the week, they said, is this enough for the winter? And the abbot said, leave it with me tonight, I'll check. And so in the middle of the night, he got out his smartphone again and rang the weatherman. And he said, how's it looking? Is it going to be just, you know, the cold what you said, or worse or less? And the professor said, actually the signs have got worse. I think it's going to be a very cold winter this year. So the following morning, the abbot said, I think it's going to be a cold winter this year. We better do some more collecting of wood. So another week, they collected more and more wood from all over the place. And they packed every storeroom as tight as they could with supplies of fuel for the cold winter. And then they said, is this enough now? He said, wait till this evening. And tomorrow morning, I'll let you know. So again, he got the weatherman and said, how is it going? And the weatherman said, this is amazing. It looks going to be really, really cold this year. So the following morning, he told all the monks, yes, it's going to be one of the coldest winters. I think we better get another week's supply of wood. So the monks did nothing else but collect wood all over the place. They put in every spare place of the monastery. And after another week, they said, is this enough? And that's when he said, I'll tell you tomorrow morning. So for the fourth time, he rang up the weatherman and said, how's it going? The weatherman said, I don't believe this, but all the signs are this is going to be the coldest winter ever recorded. Oh, thank you so much, said the monk. But before he hung up this time, he said, but how do you know? Are you sure? And at which the weatherman said, yeah, it's going to be really cold, monk, because cold winter. Because all those holy monks in the monastery are collecting so much wood. That's how I know. That's why people are being sheep, being stupid. But somebody said that to me a long time ago. He said, that's how Wall Street works. It is true, it's just rumours and fears. the price is going down. Why? Because people are selling the stocks. Why? Because the price is going down. Crazy stuff. Dear Ajahn, will you please tell a few stories? I think this is Anna. Is that you want ghost stories again? She always likes ghost stories. But anyway, I haven't got that many ghost stories. But I told this a few days ago to somebody that I do lots of funeral services. And I was doing a funeral service for a Chinese man who died as a burial. And over in Karakata Cemetery, one of the two main cemeteries here in Perth, the Chinese section is one of the furthest sections. It's discrimination. You know, all the Christians are very close by, and you know, other sort of, you know, Western religions, but the Chinese are way at the other end of the cemetery. So it's a long walk. I've done it many times. So I knew it was going to be a long walk, you know, from the assembly area to the gravesite. So I was walking in front, you know, with the funeral director. It was an elderly lady. And so, you know, just passing the time, asked her a few questions. How long have you been doing this job? She said, oh, over 30 years I've been a funeral director. I'm going to retire this year. I said, oh, great. You must know a lot of ghost stories. I always need to get some more ghost stories for Anna. So have you got any ghost stories? She said, oh, yeah, lots of them. I said, do you see ghosts often? She said, oh, yeah. She said, in the funeral parlour. You know, these are the offices. If anyone dies, you go there, you know, to select the coffins and do all the arrangements, pay the bills. There's so many funeral companies in every city, the funeral homes sometimes they call them. And that's also when they collect your your uncle or your mum or dad from your room, they put it in the box and they take it to the funeral parlour, they, you know, where they can store it until they take it to be buried or cremated. So they store the dead bodies there as well. And she said, so often I'm working in the office, and they're usually alone, and I see the ghosts walk past my office. And I have to tell them, get back in your box. And she was serious. Because, you know, they're in their box, in their coffin, and then that's where they should be, but, you know, they want to take a bit of a walk around and have a look. And so she has to be quite firm then. Get back in your box, she tells them. Anything more scary than that? She said, yeah, the scariest thing happened a few weeks earlier, she said. And she told me something I never knew before about funerals, even though I've done so many funerals. The hearse. This is the car in which they put the box. Sometimes I've ridden in the hearse, you know, because they have the guy in the front, you know, who does the driving, and there's always a spare passenger seat there. And sometimes, you know, I've got in the hearse and I went to buckle up my seatbelt, and the guy said, you don't have to worry about that. That's the one car you don't need to wear seatbelts. Because he said no policeman would dare to stop a hearse. Even they're scared. And it was even, I think, in California, in San Francisco. They had one funeral man, director. He was driving the hearse. He didn't have a passenger in the passenger seat. Just him and the box in the back. And he went down one of the lanes where it says minimum of two passengers in the car. And he got stopped by the police. He said, what are you talking about? It's me in here and the corpse in the back. That's two. And they actually went to court to test that out in law, whether it's actually counts. And apparently the judge didn't see the funeral director's side of the story and fined them for going in the wrong lane. These judges got no sense of humour at all. But anyway, the hearse is cleaned after every funeral. So even if they do three or four funerals a day, once a hearse gets back to the funeral parlour, the funeral home, they employ one person whose only job is to clean the hearse in and out, inside and outside, after every funeral. So the next funeral is always spotless. So there's an old guy who had that job in the funeral home. He just cleaned the inside of the hearse after a funeral. He just came back, cleaned it inside, locked it up, and was cleaning on the outside. When? The inside windows all steamed up from inside. All the windows had this mist on them, which had never seen that before. How could that happen? Now that was spooky enough. But then what happened next? Handprints appeared on the inside of the windows. Handprints on the windows. Something inside was trying to get out. Was that spooky? Even the funeral parlor thought that was spooky. And they're the experts. Is that okay, Anna? You want to know another one? Now that's enough for tonight. Because in your caravan tonight you may dream of all the windows misting up and you see handprints. Ah! Hi Ajahn, can the same person come for the interviews more than once, provided 10 minutes and time slots are not fully utilized? Thank you. Give other people a chance, first of all. If it really is important, then fine. But, yeah, you're allowed to come for more than once for an interview, but make sure other people have a chance. I put the interview sheet for tomorrow out there, because, again, no interviews today, because I was out all day. But tomorrow, it's business as usual. So, yeah, you can. If attaining jhana is as easy as you mentioned, relax and stay still. Why do you need to go through so much training in meditation, feeding mosquitoes, for example, or for hares, or whatever. The only reason is because people are stupid. I was stupid. That's why you had to train for such a long time, learning how to let go. Which is why that people can meditate for years and years and years and years. Because they don't know where the letting go button is. The way you know where that button is, and you just press it, everything becomes very easy. So it is because of your training in the world. From the time you went to school, I remember the time, I don't actually remember the time, but I'm sure it happened. The teacher looked at me and said, Peter, that was my name before I became a monk. What do you think of that? And I said, nothing. And I got into trouble. I thought, I was told I was stupid because I didn't think. Those teachers, they delayed my enlightenment for so many years. Just like you guys. What do you think of that? You say nothing, people just, they just don't understand the great wisdom in that. So, our whole world trains us, expects us to do things. I'm just really amazed at how busy people are these days. I remember just weekends, people used to just hang out doing nothing. You know, even Easter holidays. You know, we'd just hang out. My father would just catch up on some sleep. He wouldn't do much work. Read a newspaper, just relax. But these days, people have got to go somewhere. You have a long weekend, and they ask you, where are you going for the long weekend? What are you doing for Easter? And you say, nothing. I'm just going to stay at home. I'm going to do nothing. Oh, you're doing nothing. Can you come and help me, please? That is why I never tell people you're doing nothing, because they don't respect that at all. So instead, I have all these different ways of saying I'm doing nothing. My favourite one is I might be out there on the stoop and say, what are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? I say, nothing. Oh, can you come and help me just clean up? I say, no. I am watching the trees grow. That is one of my skillful means. So you can watch trees grow. And I've spent hours watching trees grow. You got to spend a lot. The trees, they do grow, you know. You just got to be very patient and watch. Then they grow. If you start looking at something else, you miss it. It's just an excuse for doing nothing. So people respect you for doing nothing. So you can really relax. You don't have to do stuff. You don't, especially you don't have to improve yourself. Who says you have to improve? The whole life you have to improve. You know, school you have to improve your grades, learn this, learn that. And when you're in life, you still have to improve and go to refresher courses and just and go to night school to, you know, learn some more, which you'll forget in the end anyway. You know, you go to Qigong and yoga to improve your health. You're going to die anyway, so what's the point? So why do people do this? All it does, eat healthy food. Why? It just, you know, it extends your life. But what part of your life does it extend? The very end of it, when you can't enjoy it. All it means is just a few extra years in the old people's home. Anyway, that is, the only training is because you don't know how to do it. It's not training, it's just unlearning. You've got to unlearn so much to get into a jhana. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how can you achieve enlightenment if you don't wish to have it? Because it's nothing you wish or you don't wish. It's beyond your will, whether you like it or not. It happens. You don't want to have it. If you were an enlightened person going to the Olympics, how would you compete in them if your only intention was to be the biggest loser and didn't want to compete? Is it possible to become enlightened if you don't want to be and never wish to be? Of course, nobody wants to become enlightened, because if you want it, you don't get it. But if you don't want it, then it might happen. Have you ever known in life you always get what you don't want? That's what happens in life. I don't want it, but it happens. I never wanted to be a teacher, and it happens. It's crazy. So, if you, like when you go to bed tonight, don't want to go to sleep. If you want to go to sleep, you can't. If you don't want to go to sleep because you want to meditate, then it's so easy. You go to sleep straight away. So if you want to be enlightened, no way. If you don't want to be enlightened, you've got a very good chance. And going to the Olympic Games. It would be great to go to the Olympic Games. You could win so many medals. High jump. Just levitate. Doesn't matter how high the bar is, you can go really right to the top. Of course, it's so fast. And just the marathon, the psychic power, just like they say in the sutras, a strong man flexes his arm and disappears from here and appears over there. You just disappear from the start line, you appear on the finishing line. Even Usain Bolt can't catch you if you do that sort of stuff. So you can win every medal, not even breaking out into a sweat. You know, lifting, weightlifting. You know, you just put your finger and the weight goes up. And the weight goes down. It's so simple. That's why it's no fun if they invite enlightened people to the Olympic Games. If they had an Olympic Games for enlightened people, that would be something. So see who can meditate the longest. Okay, sit down. And then we can just see who gets there. Actually, somebody sent me a video. It's actually done by New Zealand. Do you remember that one? The Meditation Olympics. It was set in New Zealand. Really crazy to see who can sit meditation longest without moving. It's just like a spoof. But, of course, why do you want to go to the Olympic Games for anyway? Well, do you win? So what? People get so excited when somebody wins. Yay! But they only get excited because of so many people lose. And their excitement, their joy is a direct proportion to how many people try and fail. If everybody won, there'd be no euphoria. So you see the euphoria of the winner, and it's all at the expense of all the people who have lost. You go home upset. They always say, oh, just to compete is enough. Yeah, sure. You ask the athletes. They want to win. And the worst suffering is the one who comes second. They get so close. So that's why competition really sucks. You know, I'm not going to finish this. The last competitive sport, you might call it, I was playing soccer at university. It was only for the college, second or third team, I forget which now. Just, you know, for fun. Not serious. You know, if you go in the first team, fair enough, you know, you're competing for the honour of the college. But, you know, I didn't want to go into those teams. I just want to have a nice bit of fun in the afternoon. And one day, it's like 11 aside soccer. So 9 of the opposition turned up and 11 of us turned up. And so after half time, the first 45 minutes, we were something like 7-0 up. Just stupid game. It was no fun. It was just one-sided. I went up to my captain and I said, can I play for the other side in the second half to make a game of it? And he swore at me. He said, of course you can't. No, worse than that. You can't play for the other side. You have to play for us. So why not? I'm here for joy. No, we've got to win. And that was the last game I ever played. I don't want to just go and play for winning and stupid games like that. I'd rather just have fun and enjoy. You know, yeah, you compete, but if you lose, you had a great game, great. That's how I was, you know, brought up. That's how I thought about things, but apparently I didn't fit in. You had to win at all costs. And people cheat and do all sorts of stupid things. Take drugs just to win. You know, why do you do that for? It wrecks your life. Anyway, dear Ajahn, you have mentioned that Ajahn Chah made you and other monks to meditate under a very hot condition after lunch. May I know what was his intention and what was the teaching behind it? His intention was so I could have stories to tell other people when I became a teacher. Gives you some cred. I don't know why he did that. Other than that, I don't know. If cause and effect governs everything that occurs, then every incident has specific causes that make it happen. And those causes are a result of another set of specific causes. And in turn, those secondary causes are a result of another set of specific causes. And so it carries on to the past. In that case, isn't everything that's happening now happens that way because of some other things that specifically happened in the past? Therefore, the present had already been decided in the past, and similarly the future also is already decided by the past and present incidents. Thank you. That question was caused by thinking too much. Stop thinking so much. That was the cause of that question. Can you explain? You see, this is why people die, because they laugh too much and get heart attacks. Can you explain more on wait in the moment, the waiting for the moment? Okay. Waiting for something to happen. You say, okay, I'm following everything Ajahn Brahm says. When's it going to happen? I'm sitting here, I'm doing nothing. But nothing's happening. You're waiting for something to happen. And you're waiting in the future. You're not in this present moment. And this is one of the problems. We wait for something to happen, and we're not looking in the place where it is happening. So we wait on the present moment. Be careful. People say, I've done everything you asked me and nothing's happened. Why? It's because you've been wanting it to happen and you've been waiting in the future. Looking out there instead of looking in this moment. Dear Ajahn, who or what is the observer, knower, as opposed to the doer? It's not a who, it's just a what, it's just mindfulness is the best word. It is awareness. And doer is reacting to what you hear or what you see. So this is being able to sit here and feel without reacting. That's why listening to the birds, looking at nature is helpful, because nature is far more powerful than you are and you can't control nature. You can go up to the bird and say, shut up, I want to meditate, be quiet. And what will the bird do? You can't control the bird. You can't just say to the wind, stop, you're too windy. It won't do that. You look at the stars at night and you say, I'm fed up with looking at the stars. No, butt out. The stars won't do that, because you know nature is independent of you and doesn't follow your orders. If you could only do that to your mind, like nature, butt out, stop trying to control it. And then you find you let go, you're at peace. That's why nature is peaceful and tranquilizing, because you don't even try to control it. People are disturbing and a pain in the butt because you think you can control them. You are the biggest pain in your butt because you try and control yourself. Let go. Right, gone quiet. That must have been profound. You always know when you say something profound, because people look at you and they go, really silent. Dear Ajahn, if you see a spider and a centipede next to you on your meditation mat, you use a piece of paper to carry them outside. However, the spider lands upside down. It seems helpless, so you use a leaf to flip it over, but realize it was the right way up before, so you flip it again. So you flip it again, you get really confused about whether the spider is the right way up or not, so you flip it a couple of more times just to make sure. Is this animal cruelty? Thank you. It's both animal cruelty and teacher cruelty by making me read this out. Let a spider decide. And anyway, the spider and centipede were coming here to listen to the Dhamma talk. And you go and take them outside. Very nice question there. Thank you so much. How do we develop powerful contentment, given that progress in meditation is directly proportional to the level of contentment? That's what I've been teaching all the last few days. Just do nothing. This is good enough. Actually, learn to see the beautiful in things. instead of the fourth. So that was the essence of the two bad bricks in the wall story. If you want to know where those two bad bricks are, because people keep on asking me, I want to go and see the two bad bricks. So you get a photograph. Here's me next to Ajahn Brahm's two bad bricks. So you can tell your friends, I've been to Bodhinyana Monastery. But apparently it's in the monks' quarters, monks' toilets, which you're not allowed to go to. So don't ask to go in the monks' toilets so you can take a photograph of the two bad bricks. Ooh. Anyway, so, but that story of why is it we always see the faults? In our meditation? Maybe in our body? My knee aches. What about the rest of your body? It's fine. Why do you focus on just one part of the body which aches and forget about the rest of it? So we are such fault finders. We always go to the faults, the mistakes, things which are wrong. And that's sometimes why we don't have any contentment. As soon as you see a fault, now you've got business. You've got to fix it up. So instead, you look at the other part, which isn't faulty. But as a senior monk, as an abbot, I have responsibilities. So people tell me. But I try and be irresponsible. My management guru, you know, we all follow a school of management, was a fellow called Sergeant Schultz in the TV series Hogan's Heroes. Now, you have to be my age to see this one, but he was a classic manager. He was supposed to be in charge of these American POWs in a refugee camp. And every time he saw these American, Hogan's Heroes, American POWs going out to the pub in the village, which was totally verboten, you know, that means forbidden, he put his hands over his eyes and say, I see nothing, I see nothing, I see nothing. And that is my school of management. When I see my monks misbehaving or the nuns messing around, I see nothing, I hear nothing. And then I have a nice peaceful life. So whatever you want to do, I see nothing. He was such a funny man, but there's actually a lot of wisdom in that. Why are you always looking at the faults? But you see a monk doing something very beautiful. Wow, I see that. I hear the monks doing some beautiful chanting. Oh, I'm going to listen to that. But when he's chanting out of tune, I hear nothing, I hear nothing. And that way, you develop contentment. Happy to be here. It's not the best place in the world, but it's pretty good as retreat centers go. But have you already thought of improvements? Suppose that we had a complaints box here, a little box in the back, instead of the question box, where how we can improve this center. Now, what? one thing would be to ban nuns. And I did the talkative ones. So, how can we improve this center? First of all, anyone who bangs the doors, they're on the blacklist, can never go on a retreat center again. Anyone who breaks the noble silence in the cottage, they're also blacklisted. Anybody who eats too much, anyone who asks stupid questions, blacklisted. That's how we can, only real meditators, that's the only ones we're going to have here. That's how we can really improve this meditation center. Have you ever noticed, once you get into how can we improve, it's endless. Individual air conditioners coming down from the room, so you can actually get your right temperature for you. Now, fatter meditation cushions. Have you ever noticed that when you get into that fault-finding mind, it is endless. You can always make things better. That's why you can never have find any peace. Try to improve things. That is endless. Contentment is saying, you see, oh, this is good enough, this is quite nice. It's good enough. Enough food, enough quiet. Yeah, it's not maybe too hot for some people, too cold for others, but, you know, it's not going to give you a sickness. It's good enough. Yeah, people talk. Yeah, I know, but it's only a small amount. They're not shouting, they're not playing Jimi Hendrix and rock music, you know, in their cottages all night. So it's not that bad. So that means you learn how to be content. And when you're content, there's no business anymore. That is how you develop contentment. Avoiding the fault-finding mind. Dear, does Jhanagraha have open days for members of the public to have a look around? Every day is open. We always have some people, they just walk in here and have a look around. I couldn't believe this. There was, the gate is always open. Even it says in there, there's a sign saying, private, you have to ask permission of Ajahn Brahm to come in here. But still people come in here. And I was doing my interviews there, and a couple of tourists came in, and they saw, interview, if you want an interview, put your name down. And they weren't even on retreat, they put their names down. Well, you say, I mean, so they gave me another story to tell to let you laugh. So we don't have open days where we invite the general public. So it's just because, you know, it's already hard enough to get on these retreats. Imagine if everybody knew about this place. You never have a chance at all to get on this retreat. So just those with good enough karma to know about this place, you can come. Do you enjoy your day? Please tell something about it. Oh, my day today was really busy. We had, the Thai New Year celebration, the closest Sunday to the New Year's. The problem is, just like any other community, some Thais get on together, some don't. So there's two main groups. Started off with the yellow shirts and the red shirts. And of course I follow the brown shirts, the monks. And so, but then there's always conflict because of egos, that my group is better than your group. So there was two New Year celebrations. So we had to try and look after both. But the one in the temple was just much bigger than ever before. And all the council was on our backs for parking all over the place. And oh, so much. But it actually went round pretty well today. So I was a bit concerned when I went there that everything was well organized. But it was. So it's amazing how if you really talk to people, they really want to do the very best. Because they respect our temple. And so they really worked hard and made it a very successful day today. With everybody working together. So today, actually the smell's gone off. There's about 2,000 people pouring perfumed water over your fingers. Why they do that, I don't know. They say it's to wash away their sins. Well, just take a bath and use carbolic soap or something. But it is the custom. And it's much better than what happened in Thailand in the northeast. Because in the northeast, it wasn't just your fingers they had to wash on the New Year Day. It was everything, your whole body. So the villagers, they would make this enclosure, and with this out of spare corrugated iron, a chute, and it would just go over the enclosure, and you had to sit on a bench just with your bathing cloth on, and then the women would pour the water, because they weren't allowed in, you know, see, half naked monk, pour the water, you know, in the chute, and you get drowned. And all the villagers there would, you know, rub you here and rub you there to wash you. And of course, you know, because, you know, monks were young and Western, a few of the girls looked over the, over into the compound to see what was going on, messing around, because Thai people are fun-loving. They're always naughty when they can be. And that was really hard. You could hardly breathe sometimes. And after washing you, then they'd all come into the hall and ask forgiveness for what they've just done. Oh, it was really good fun. And it was also just, it was a thing every year on the New Year Day. You'd ask forgiveness of all the Sangha, anything you've done of the past year which has upset you. Then you always ask forgiveness. And myself, on behalf of all the monks and nuns, I ask forgiveness of the lay people. Anything which I have done. All the bad jokes. all the stories I've repeated again and again and again. I ask forgiveness. And we ask people to do that together as well. Husbands and wives, once a year, ask forgiveness of one another. If there's anything I've done over the past year, by body, speech or mind, I ask forgiveness. And then you have to give forgiveness. It's our Buddhist tradition. If someone sincerely says, I ask forgiveness, then you have to forgive sincerely. And then you ask forgiveness of them. And why, for anything I've done, please forgive me. It's a beautiful ceremony when it's done properly. And I love that ceremony. That's one of the nicest parts of it. So everyone asks forgiveness of one another. When my mind wants a cup of coffee, I follow it. How do I know that is being kind of indulgence in the five senses? If it's your mind wants it, fine. If your body wants it, that's something else. Because the mind is smarter than the body. The body craves. But the mind is usually wise. So you ask your mind, do you really want it? And a lot of times the mind says, actually, no. I'm fine, thank you very much. But the body wants to taste. So listen to the mind, don't listen to the body. Dear Ajahn, my body takes advantage of my kindness. It sleeps all the time. It cannot sleep all the time, otherwise you would not be able to write this question. At least there was a few minutes when you weren't sleeping. So it doesn't all the time. I mean, a lot of the time. Which means that you were sleepy. After Q&A session, I went straight to bed and wake up at 5 a.m. After the morning talk, I listened to my body and went to sleep till lunchtime. After lunch, I slept again for 2 hours. When I meditate, I fall asleep. Believe me, I do not have sleep deficit before I come here. What to do? Please help. Maybe I do not have enough good karma for meditation. No, try and sleep more. Reverse psychology. And when you want to sleep more, you find you can't. So you do that for a little while, and then after a while you get bored with sleeping. You can't even go to sleep. So that's the time, okay, I know I've slept enough. And then find some joy in being here. Why do you come to the talks or the Q&A? Because it's fun. So make the meditation fun. Do kangaroo walking meditation. Whoever wrote that question, I order you to do 5 minutes of kangaroo walking meditation after the morning talk and after the Q&A. You have to do that because that will get rid of all your sleepiness. It brings you some fun. So sometimes the sleepiness is boredom because you're not putting enough joy and fun in your meditation. And if you want to do things, don't just sit in the same place. Just sit in a different place. Don't sit facing the other way. Do things differently. Or, I developed a technique called backwards breath meditation. Makes it easier. The first time this has been developed since the time of the Buddha. Backwards breath meditation. You learn it here, first of all, before it takes over the whole world. Backwards breath meditation. Now how that works is, you don't even close your eyes, you close your eyes if you wish to. Please breathe in and out 3 times. Now I can guarantee, when I ask you to breathe in and out 3 times, your first breath was the in-breath. It was in, out, in, out, in, out. Now do the exercise again, but start with the out-breath. Out, in, out, in, out, in. Close your eyes and 3 breaths starting with out, in, out, in, out, in. That is called backwards breath meditation. And it is a totally different experience than breathing in first. In, out, in, out, in, out is one way of doing breath meditation, but doing out, in, out, in, out, in is different. It makes it interesting. So you don't get sleepy. And meditation becomes fun. If you don't want to do the kangaroo walking meditation and you get sleepy, then do a mantra with your walking. When you move your left foot, you say something to yourself. And then when you move your right foot, you say something else to yourself. And the best mantra is, left foot moves, I will die, right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Now you can't argue with that. No matter what faith, religion or view, that is true. So a lot of times if you do that, I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And you can do that too, because even young people die as well, you know. So it's not just your mum we're talking about, it's you as well. And you, Anna, as well. I will die, that's for sure, when you walk. When you do that, first of all, it's funny. And then after you go through the idea of a joke, you realize how true it is. And if you really do it, you get fear. I will die, that's for sure. But you keep walking until you can walk through the fear. And then you let go. You're going to die. Why are you worried about all this stuff for? Why are you worried about the economy, what's happening in the United States, relationships, trying to get enlightened? You're going to die. So when you really do that, I will die, that's for sure. It's so easy to let go of stuff. You're going to die anyway. So let go. Okay, I'm not going to answer this question. Can you please kindly give your views as to the actions we can possibly take in order to stay mindful when we get into our normal lives once the retreat is over? If you can't be mindful enough now to be in this moment and forget about what's going to happen when the retreat is over, it's a waste of time giving instructions when you're in the busyness of your life. So, wait to those questions until you're back in your normal life. Stop being so far ahead of yourself. And if you can do that on this retreat, forget about the last day until it actually becomes the last day, then that is a training where you can be mindful in your daily life. If you can't do it now, you're not going to be very successful afterwards. What did the Buddha mean by wholesome and unwholesome? How would you describe it? That's kusala and akusala. It means like suitable for the purpose. So, if your purpose is to, you know, do your job, then you have to work hard. If you are driving Ajahn Brahm over to a ceremony today, then it's wholesome not to watch your breath. If you're watching your breath while you're driving me to Nolamara, you will crash the car. So it is wholesome to be watching the road and thinking about the traffic. But that is unwholesome if you're doing that here. So wholesome, unwholesome is dependent upon the purpose of what you're doing. So, as I mentioned already, if you are washing the dishes, it's unwholesome to let go. The plate will fall and crack. When you're cleaning the pots, it is unwholesome to say, good enough. You'll get in big trouble with Bianca. So unwholesome, wholesome, depends on the purposes. And when the Buddha was talking about wholesome and unwholesome, he was talking for the purpose of getting enlightened. So if you want to get enlightened, the wholesome, unwholesome, the skillful, unskillful, I prefer skillful and unskillful. It depends on what your purpose is. Oh. You okay? It's 9:15. There's only two or three questions to go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if you are hungry at night and you cannot finish all the food you took at lunch, are you allowed to put the leftover food in a box and eat it in the evening? Would this be stealing or wasting food or breaking the precepts of not eating although you are hungry? Thank you. The hunger is only in your mind, only because you think of food. It's amazing that, you know, even myself, you know, you have enough for lunch, but what happens is sometimes you go on an aircraft, and in economy class, you're sitting next to another person. And this happened. I was coming on Cathay Pacific back from Hong Kong to here, and it was afternoon, and the person next to me, I saw they had for their, you know, 3 o'clock, you know, snack. They had a pie and mushy peas. I've never ever seen that on an aircraft before. The only time I've seen mushy peas served on an aircraft is one of my favourites, and it was in the afternoon. Normally I'm not hungry, but I looked on that and said, oh, why does this happen to me and it's in the afternoon and I can't eat it? This is unfair. I'm going to complain to the cabin crew. Please, you know, can I have some of those iPads so I can't see what my neighbour is eating? Because if it's something you like and you think about it, of course you get hungry. But it was only just, you know, desire, nothing else. I didn't need it. So you're not going to die if you don't get your food in the afternoon. So instead, just forget about the hunger. You've got enough. You know, check your belly. If, you know, do what I do. Always have a bit spare for the afternoon and evening. Actually, I've got too much spare. So it is cheating, especially to take food and take it back with you. Unless you're really sickly. Yeah, there's some people, they have to take antibiotics or something, so they need something in their tummy. Otherwise, you know, it will screw up their tummy. That's fine. Ask Bianca, and you get permission to do that. What is the difference between sati and sampajanya? That's sati. I mentioned this a little bit earlier today. Sati is mindfulness. Sampajanya is wisdom. That's why sometimes Ajahn Chah, he wouldn't use sampajanya, he would use the shortened form, panya. Sam means with, pajanya is a contracted form of pajanya, is panya. So he said with mindfulness and wisdom. So it's not just being mindful, it's being wise as well. The old joke, there was a very wealthy lady who was a very good meditator. She went to the temple one evening and she told the guard on her mansion, because, you know, very wealthy woman, so had a guard on her mansion security, and told the guard, there are burglars in the vicinity, please be mindful. He said, yes, madam, I will. And so she went to the temple, and when she came back, she found her house had been robbed. And she said, I told you to be mindful. I've been robbed. And the guard said, I was mindful, madam. I saw the burglars going in, and I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them taking your safe out. I noted, safe going out, safe going out, safe going out. I saw them going in again, and I was very mindful. I saw them, burglar going in, burglar going in. I noted jewelry going out. I was mindful all the time, madam. Perfectly alert, perfectly aware. Exactly, that's a very stupid guard. It's not just being mindful, it's being wise as well. So, yes, you're being aware, but you have responsibility to do something. You're not in meditation retreat, you're a guard. Call the police, do something. That's wisdom. As someone who too has been taught to bring the mind back to the breath, I find your way of letting it be refreshing. Yeah, I do too. However, how can we be mindful of the desires of Mara versus the legitimate needs of our body? If one wants a cup of tea rather than to sit in meditation, could this be Mara acting on us? How to be differentiate? It's at first listen to your body, because as you get more relaxed and more still, your mindfulness gets stronger, and then you can actually listen to your mind much more clearly and accurately, and you begin to distinguish what really is craving and, you know, what is unnecessary and what is actually looking after your body. Until you get strong mindfulness, people usually are too hard on themselves. So err on the side of indulgence. And I say that having been a meditation teacher a long time. It's usually not Mara. It's usually common sense. But people are too tough on themselves. And they get too tight. And they never get relaxed enough to get into deep meditation. So indulge. Sometimes you indulge too much. But most times that you are too ascetic. I cannot feel breath in my nostrils. I can only feel the rise and fall in my chest. Can I just watch these? No, watch neither. Don't watch your nostrils. Don't watch your belly. Watch your breath. Where you are aware of the breath doesn't matter. As long as you're aware of the breath. You're breathing? How do you know you're breathing? I used to have, still have, at the right time of the year, hay fever. So my nose blocks up. I can't be aware of any breath at the nostrils because there's nothing happening there. There's no air going in and out. It's blocked. Hay fever. And then, watching your tummy rise and fall. It works in the morning time and maybe just after lunch, but you try and watching the rise and fall in your chest at this time in the evening, it is so close to your stomach. Oh, I feel hungry. So the best thing is actually not to watch the stomach, not to watch the nose, but to watch the breath. Ask yourself, am I breathing in or breathing out? How do you know? So disembody it. Don't care or be concerned where the breath is manifesting. Just know enough it's coming in or it's going out. That's all. That helps enormously with your meditation. You are breathing. How do you know? That feeling, that sensation which tells you what the breath is doing is all you need to watch. Don't be concerned if it's at the nose or at the tummy. So there we go. The questions are now finished. So you've been very, very patient with me this evening. It's 9:25. So now is the time to finish off. For those people who have been sleeping too much, that person, you can't go back to bed now. You have to do some kangaroo walking meditation first for 5 minutes at least, then you can go to bed. Sadhu! 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 Have a wonderful night. But you don't have to. I don't like controlling people. So if you want to have a miserable life, a miserable night, so that's totally up to you. Sure.